We are going to have a discussion right now in the English language. But how did the English language get to be what it is, and how well or how poorly is it used? Not merely by the two participants in this discussion, but by all the rest of us. The two participants are myself, as one might have said in Victorian England, and an old friend of mine, Craig Searles, who is professor of English at DePaul University, former chairman of that department. But already we come upon, Craig, one of the basic topics that we've examined before, namely differences in pronunciation. I call you Craig, and lots of people would call you Craig. In fact, I don't remember whether you, in your own mind, you are a Craig or a Craig.
I'm a Craig, but I'm not from New York or from Britain, which is, I think, about the only two places where Craig is said.
Not only in New York, not even down the eastern seaboard?
I don't think so, because really? I'm from the Middle Atlantic, and it's Craig there.
Yeah.
I am from a dialect area that makes a distinction between M-A-R-R-Y mm-hmm. and M-E-R-R-Y.
Yes.
But I don't make a further distinction with M-A-R-Y, which certainly New Yorkers do. So
yes, there's a basic test there about where you're from with a sentence which runs simply as follows. Mary, Mary, married.
Yes.
Now, I did the three different forms of the vowel.
Yes.
So I guess that marks me as a New Yorker then, does it?
Absolutely marks you as
a New Yorker. And how do you do it?
Well, it would be Mary had a merry Christmas and then was married.
Yeah.
So I make a distinction between Harry and Harry, as in mm-hmm. hirsute, and in the Midwest, these things are all collapsed.
It's a small issue, or it's a vast issue. We're not going to really spend too much time on it today. But how, in fact, do these regional differences develop?
Well, the earliest settled places, which are on the East Coast, tend to be the most linguistically conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And as
conservative in that they stay closer to received English pronunciation?
No, they resist
change of any kind.
They resist change, and that's what conservatism means.
Oh, sure.
And the opposite of that is innovation. The farther west you go, the less you're likely to have recognizable dialect boundaries, simply because what would have gone into Kansas was then followed by other groups in Kansas and others and others and others. So regional dialects essentially break up once you get into about the middle of Indiana. And that is that they start generalizing it into what's known as general American.
Well, but if you go south from Indiana to, say, Kentucky,
yeah,
or to Texas, you're going to run into very strong regional accents.
Yes, yes, yes. So what you have is you have a kind of reverse-shaped C that may go from, say, Minnesota and the north, and then it goes all the way to the Atlantic, and then sort of then around to Texas and Arkansas there. And in the middle, you have what's known as the Midland dialect. Now, one of the really interesting things is when we talk about what is the perfect American accent, or the one that is considered what we would all think of as, well, that's American dialect. Do you remember the recorded time announcements on your telephone where the time is 4 minutes or 4 o'clock and 12 seconds exactly? They found someone, a woman, about 20 miles south of Columbus, Ohio, to record all of those things because it was believed that she was accent-free.
Whatever that means.
In other words,
to be accent-free, you wouldn't be able to talk at all.
She did not exhibit East Coast. She didn't exhibit sort of the north, and she certainly did not exhibit any of the south or the Ozark area right there. But if you're talking about Nebraska, for example, does Nebraska have a recognizable dialect? And the answer is no. It seems to be basically the same as Colorado. And
one little anomaly or a little strange twist in regional pronunciation may be as widely dispersed as through a whole country. And the country I have in mind is Canada, though this particular thing laps over into Minnesota, maybe, and so on. And it's simply best conveyed by a sentence. We have a rather larger, fleshly trout fish, which is flapping around in the water. And you say that the stout trout floated about. That's the Canadian OU. It is not a, I assume it's sort of Scots in origin.
I'm not sure if it is or not, but there's also...
There's a pocket in Virginia which
there's
uses
There's a pocket in Virginia. It's Tidewater, Virginia, North yeah. Carolina, which says, which uses the same thing. But yeah. that's a little linguistic island right there. Yeah. But the thing is, it's not really the OU. It's the OU plus what's known as a voiceless consonant, as in T. So they would say... they would say trout,
yeah.
but they would say crowd. They would say crowd, but they would say sauerkraut. So uh-huh. so it is conditioned by that D or that T. And that seems to go pretty much from Ontario all the way to the west
mm-hmm.
In yeah. Canada. And it hardly has crossed south of the border.
It's distinctively Canadian when you hear it.
Yeah.
It's pathognomonic for Canadian speech.
Yeah.
On to another subject. I'll tell our listeners that you and I have been engaged for many years, together with some other good friends, in a program that we labeled The Use and Abuse of the English Language. And, of course, you and I have differed a little bit in that you've been more permissive about colloquialisms that creep into the language and maybe violate the rules of grammar or the rules of pronunciation, because English professors are more permissive about that, whereas stuck-up old... radio talk show hosts who think they've had something of a humanistic education other than excessively tolerant teaching of English tend to maybe demand more. But basically, we haven't been too wide apart in that which sends a sort of a discomfort up the spine when you hear it.
Well, I wanted to, first of all, say au contraire with your indictment of English professors.
I'm not indicting at all. I'm just
sorry,
describing.
I'm being facetious. But I'm a linguist by training, so linguists are my literature colleagues in English are sometimes as verklempt as you are with changing usages. One of the courses.
What you just did, of course. Is revert to a Yiddish word.
Yes, of course.
Verklempt. How do you define verklempt?
Oh my gosh, it's well, you, to use a Britishism, you got your knickers in a knot. So
yeah.
So
good.
One of the courses I teach is the graduate history of the English language, and I tell my students that the history of the English language is actually a chronicling of the changes of the language, and which are brought about by new communicative needs, like the internet and all the new words has come in.
Well, earlier still brought about by invasions.
Yes, or invasions and cultural contact.
Yeah.
But another one, and this one is so significant, is that the history of English is also the history of mistakes made by English speakers. And then these mistakes become conventionalized. If you think about grammatical gender in English, everyone who studies Spanish or French knows that, well, there's nouns are either masculine or feminine. And in German, of course, they're masculine, feminine, and neuter. Well, in Old English, you had those three genders. What happened, though, was the influx of French vocabulary coming in during the Norman Conquest, and then following, say, up until around 1300, there were about 10,000 French words which entered the language. Those did not enter with the French genders. So the word table, which in French is feminine,
yeah, la table,
just came in as table,
yeah.
And it was treated as a neuter word. So what happened was that... Over about 200 years, English speakers were making the mistake of dropping all of the grammatical genders of native English words as well. So by the time you get to Chaucer, there's absolutely no grammatical gender whatsoever. And you said, well, that's just an evolution. No, it's actually a series of mistakes that everyone made over a period.
Fortunately, because the... concerned about getting the proper gender for one or another of 1,000 nouns, after a while, if you're learning it as a second language, can be a little discombobulating.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Now, how do you like discombobulating as a word?
I believe discombobulate is actually a made-up word.
Oh, it is, of course.
I think it is.
It's so, the history of it I do not know.
Yes.
But at the same time, you are bothered by certain... are they Lapsi linguae or Lap... Yes, they are.
Well, let me give you some categories that... I mean, when I was thinking about what I might tell you on the show, it was... I knew we were going to be talking about language change and also something about errors that
and over the years, as I said, we've talked so often about the use and abuse.
Yes.
Special stress on abuse of the English language.
One of the categories that I see for change in language, which is brought about by mistakes, would be similar looking or sounding but non-synonymous words. So... to flaunt the law as opposed to flout the law. Mm-hmm. And you hear this by educated speakers.
Very common mistake.
By educated speakers. I've heard enervate used for energize, even though those are antonyms, but they sound similar enough that people are going to, well, it was enervated, so he was all energized up. Two mistakes that I see my students making, and I also see... television commentators making is the collapsing of simple and simplistic and fortuitous and fortunate. And it's what I call maybe the theory of the larger word. And this is when you're trying to inflate your own linguistic presence, then you go for that larger word. So you'll see people using utilize when maybe they should be using you, because utilize seems just a little bit loftier.
Well, now you're... You're venturing across the barrier into the academic world.
Oh, well, yes. Yeah, well, the
where polysyllabic excess is sort of the mark of the species, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I'm really now not talking about academic writers. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about speakers. I'm talking about talking heads on television.
Yeah.
And you will hear, if you listen to a football broadcast where one of the commentators will say that was a very fortuitous catch when it was a well, it could be fortuitous, but it was fortunate that he caught the thing because the Bears won the game.
Fortuitous
means by accident.
By accident, essentially.
By accident. Yeah. And I think really a worse one is simplistic as the synonym for simple.
Yeah.
And they said, well, that was the answer is very simplistic. And I said, no, you don't. I had a student a number of years ago who wrote a paper where she identified herself as very opinionated on some particular topic. And I told her, I said, opinionated is not what you mean here. She said, oh, yes, it is. I have a very strong opinion on the thing. And I said, but that's not what opinionated means. And it was this Humpty Dumpty. Well, that's how I use it.
Let me show you about something I encountered watching television, which really amazed me. There's a rather literate and quite charming detective series based upon Sherlock Holmes, but it's set in modern times, and Sherlock is, I guess, an Englishman, but his
sidekick... Inspector Morse?
No, it's called... Elementary or something like that. It's Elementary, my dear Watson.
Okay.
And he's Sherlock Holmes, and he's got a female sidekick who is something or other Watson, and they work in New York, set in his apartment in New York and various other settings as part of the mystery. Each one is a separate mystery for one night. And I've enjoyed this program. I've looked at it a number of times. And suddenly, this simple... a lapse, which I could not believe to have been the case, because it seems to be written by a fairly literate and sophisticated person or set of persons. Sherlock says to Watson something like, me and you have to go see the chief about this one. Not you and I, but me and you.
Yeah.
And that wasn't intentionally
now,
to convey.
Now, was this Sherlock
something.
Saying this, or was this inspector?
This was Sherlock talking to his Dr. Watson.
That's quite out of character, you see.
I would certainly
have accepted that if it had been a a detective.
Yeah.
But not.
This is the eminent Sherlock Holmes. He's one of the smartest men in the world, except possibly equaled only by Professor Moriarty,
yes,
who shows up in this thing as well. But that pronoun confusion is one of the major areas of trouble, is it not?
And what linguists call this is hypercorrection, and this is. I could say me and Milt went to the hockey game last night and said, no, Craig, you have to say Milt and I. So
you could even say I and Milt if you wanted to.
Well, yes, that would be non-idiomatic.
True.
And actually what a linguist would say, that would be ungrammatical if it's non-idiomatic.
Uh-huh. All right.
But the message is that I is the correct form and me is the less correct form.
Yeah.
So then we start getting into Jack invited Milt and I to dinner last night, or we could use the possessive. And I've heard this. It said, "Oh, why don't you come over to Milt and I's tonight?"
Yeah,
which I've heard. Mm-hmm. Who and whom are a problem? Because whom seems to be the corrector of the two. And he said, "Whom do you think you are?" Is you'll hear this, or I will vote for whomever will create the most jobs for next year. And I see students.
Is that definitively incorrect?
It's
the last one.
Yeah, for whom
should be whoever.
Who,
of course.
Yes, whoever will, because it's the subject of that embedded
where
clause.
Where would
right
whomever
there
be required?
It would be I will vote for whomever you suggest.
Uh-huh.
You know, I will vote for whomever, and in other words, it's in the object form. But you'll see this. And I was once asked by a professor at Northwestern. He was a history professor, but he asked me. He said, "Now you are whom?" And and I didn't say meme, but this is part of it. I think one of the famous examples, though, of this hypercorrection with pronouns was. You remember, I don't know if you ever interviewed Edwin Newman. Did you ever?
I did, as a matter
well,
of fact.
Well, you know,
he was
a language maven, and he wrote those two books back in the
Simon and
yes.
others who humiliated us constantly.
Well, Newman was not really the ideologue that Simon was.
No,
I mean, he was really talking about the guardian of the public
language.
A more
gracious fellow, yeah.
And Brent Musburger, the commentator, the sportscaster, was the host of the CBS show. It was called, I can't remember the name of it, NFL Today, which preceded the Sunday games. And his co-host was Phyllis George, who I think had been a Miss America winner or something. And he ended one of the segments with, "Phyllis and myself will be back following these important announcements."
Myself is a constant use as an evasion of the
yes.
confusion.
So what Edwin Newman did in his book, A Civil Tongue, Will Americans Be the Death of English? He titled one of his chapters, "Myself Will Be Back Following These Important
yes.
Announcements." So you get that hyper correction and linguistic
insecurity.
There may
be something Irish about that, strangely. Just occurs to me. You know how in Irish usage, at least as represented by Singe, or one of those people in plays about the Irish, somebody says, "Is your husband here?" "Himself is at..." The tavern or something. You know.
Well, yes, I think he may have been talking about Christy Mann, right? Or what, in Playboy?
Maybe or? Playboy of the Western World.
Yes, yeah. I think.
But referring to another senior man as himself. Rather
oh,
than
yes, him. Yes. Yeah. I don't know if that's dialect or not, but that almost seems to be more stylistic or rhetorical, which I would accept for...
We've reviewed some, but certainly not all... that would show up on a list of misuses of the language one way or another. But it is my observation as a long-term, at the end of a long sentence as a college professor, and you are still filling out your sentence as a college professor, that over the years, our students grow less and less proficient with the English language, whether in the writing of it or the speaking thereof. I love thereof. And do you agree with me?
I absolutely agree with you, and I will also tell you that students graduating from high school today do not know the corpus of words that students graduating 45 years ago when I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
They're not doing as much reading as they were, and the books that they're being assigned tend to be shorter and simpler than they were.
They're not really doing any reading at all. They may be forced to read something or other for an assignment, but picking up a book in your leisure time to amuse yourself or to interest yourself, that just doesn't really happen.
No.
Among the young the world over, I would say.
I ride the CTA from the north side down to the Lincoln Park campus every
day.
Here
in Chicago.
In Chicago. And I see almost no one under 30 reading a book.
Yeah.
I'm either doing a crossword or reading a book, and I'm doing nothing else. They're staring at that little box that's got their tweets and whatever else on it. That seems to be what they're doing.
Yeah.
So
they're not even reading a newspaper.
No, they're not reading a newspaper. And I was once asked by a student, she said, now, how do you know, remember all these differences between alter and alter? I mean, it's the same word. And I said, well, I probably encountered it in reading someplace. I mean, that's how I think I know, you know, most of the things that I know in terms of.
You remember what we have in Orwell's 1984, namely a basic lesson that if you deprive the citizen of the future state of major sectors of his vocabulary, he can't do the thinking that might make trouble for the state. That we think and talk in words, and if you diminish the vocabularistic differentiation of which the person might be capable, you diminish his ability to think, to analyze, to criticize, to be an individual, a true individual, responding in terms of his individual values and individual sensitivities. That's Orwell's device, and we have from him as well his invention of newspeak, a way of conveying very limited meanings through a very, very reduced vocabulary. We also have him, he displays, or that is Big Brother, who rules that future dystopia, displays signs saying, oh, war is peace, love is hate, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think the best one is slavery is freedom.
Slavery is freedom.
Yes.
Is it a worry that one ought to take seriously that even our kids these days in this great and persisting democracy are somewhat less capable of serious and effective critical citizenship because of their linguistic diminution?
To me, I think the Orwell work that speaks more to that is Politics in the English Language, which he wrote in 1937, because 1984 was clearly a complete perversion of language. The worry that I have is that students coming out of high school and students coming out of college today are not able to make the critical distinctions, the nuanced comments, or to understand nuanced differences in things because they're not equipped with the vocabulary to do these things. And I think what this means is that issues become increasingly Manichaean. They become black and white.
Uh-huh.
They become much more simple. It's us versus them, these sorts of things. And certainly, look at what's happened to the country. If you could say that half of this country is watching MSNBC and the other half is watching Fox, and no one is watching CNN unless there's a tornado, because they tend to see things as either absolute right and absolute wrong, or reverse on
or absolute left.
Yes, yes. So that is a concern that I. That's a concern that I have. But
and it may very well be a general effect throughout the world. I wonder if even going to other nations in the same linguistic realm as we are—that is, sharing English—I wonder whether in England one would observe the same. Whether in Australia, whether in Canada. The educational systems differ somewhat from country to country.
Well, I do know that I do know that Europeans are in the classroom a good deal more than American kids are, and I know that Asian kids are, and I'm speaking specifically about the Japanese. They are as well. Of course, we could also talk about this whole notion of self-esteem that that seems to be going on as well, this is that.
How does that relate to a lower level of linguistic proficiency?
Well, if you're in an introductory poetry class, and you said, "Well, let's see what Thomas Gray is saying about this poem, or maybe a more contemporary," and then it's not atypical for a student to say, "Well, this reminds me when my grandfather died." And I was 14 years old. And I said, no, this poem is not about your grandfather. and so what has happened is students have been taught that these texts are actually theirs to own, that they're sort of part of, as readers, they're sort of part of the writers of these things. I said, no, what we have to do is we have to go very, very slowly through this and see what Thomas Gray or whoever is.
It's tricky territory here. Modern critical theory, so-called, has many variations, most of them seeming rather foolish to an outside observer. One of them is reader response theory, which argues essentially that there is no meaning in the text. All the meaning exists in the response of the reader.
Yes, it's the reader who carries the message and then assigns and then assigns this. And but you know, we can also go in terms of maybe worrying about the state of the language to what the academics are doing. We would sort of think that they are they would be the guardians of purity. I have the title of an academic paper that was presented in Chicago, and it's just astonishing. It was done by a graduate student at Chicago Theological Seminary and presented at the American Academy of Religion meeting last November here. And the title is Mimetic Conception, Infertility Treatment as Deconstruction and Reinscription of Western Maternality and Heteronormativity, which is astonishing. It's extraordinary. It's as though what we have is we have a bunch of placeholders in this sentence where you can simply drop in this sort of jargon.
But
right
there is intended meaning. If you know how to decrypt those words, certain attitudes lie behind the title. For example, the very last word, heteronormativity, is a term used by theorists of gender and often theorists who are also sort of apologists for gay lifestyle. It's a way of heteronormativity is the mistake made by people who think that heterosexuality is somehow preferable to homosexuality.
Yeah. No, I understand, but it's when we look at this concatenation of words right here, it's extraordinary, and it's completely ununderstandable to anyone except this tiny little fraternity of literary scholars or cultural studies scholars right here. That was not the case 25 or 30 or 40 years ago. And I know that I think Judith Butler, who was nominated as
head of the Modern Language Association.
Yes, but she won first prize a number of years ago for the worst piece of academic writing.
The bad writing contest.
And she defended it and said, no, we need this specialized vocabulary because the English language by itself is incapable of this. And I think it was your colleague Martha Nussbaum who wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times following just pillaring her.
So she did.
You know. Yeah. But it seems to me that there are little buzzwords now that you're seeing more and more. The prefix post and such things as we have post-Lacanian and post-Foucauldian and post-capitalist and post-literate, post-textual right here. I'm just not sure exactly what those things mean because those concepts didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago. or sorry, those that vocabulary didn't exist. And I've been around academics long enough to know that all that's new really isn't all that new.
It's sealed just hermetic world in which essentially you earn your spurs or earn your credits by mastering the arcane vocabulary and mastering the arcane concepts and doing, I fear, not very often serious independent analytic thought. But that's true not merely in the humanities, not merely in departments of English or departments of Germanic literature or what have you. It's true increasingly in the social sciences.
Oh, yes, yes, of
generally.
Course. Of course.
I can testify to that as somebody who trained as and worked for many years as a social psychologist.
Yeah.
We are just about out of time. Find, if you would, and I know you will be able to, an epigram which somehow closes our conversation in a delightful and yet thought-provoking way.
Well, what I have is I brought in a list of common phrasings that you find in academics, and then their real translations.
All right.
And it's it has long been known, which really means is I didn't look up the original reference. a definite trend is evident, which means the data are practically meaningless. And finally, a highly significant area of exploratory study means that I learned absolutely nothing in this study. So
good enough.
So
Craig Searles. Craig, not Craig. Craig Searles, thank you very much for joining us.